Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 253. It's Monday, April 8th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start up with a little bit of good news today. This from healthdata.org. Life expectancy increased as world addressed major killers, including diarrhea, lower respiratory infections, and stroke. Global life expectancy increased by 6.2 years since 1990, according to a new study published in The Lancet. Over the past three decades, reductions in death from leading killers fueled this progress, including diarrhea and lower respiratory infections, as well as stroke and ischemic heart disease. When the COVID-19 pandemic arrived in 2020, however, it derailed progress in many locations. This is the first study to compare deaths from COVID-19 to deaths from other causes globally. Despite the challenges presented by the COVID-19 pandemic, the researchers found that the super region of Southeast Asia, East Asia, and Oceania had the largest net gain in life expectancy between 1990 and 2021, of a gain of 8.3 years. This was largely due to reductions in mortality from chronic respiratory diseases, stroke, lower respiratory diseases, and cancer. This superregion's strong management of the COVID-19 pandemic helped preserve these gains. South Asia had the second largest net increase in life expectancy among the different superregions between 1990 and 2021 at 7.8 years, primarily thanks to steep declines in deaths from diarrheal diseases. The study also highlights how COVID-19 radically altered the top five causes of death for the first time in 30 years. COVID-19 displaced a long dominant killer, stroke, to become the second leading cause of death globally. The research presents data estimates from the Global Burden of Disease Study 2021. The authors found that the superregions where the COVID-19 pandemic hit hardest were Latin America and the Caribbean and Sub-Saharan Africa, which lost the most years of life expectancy due to COVID-19 in 2021. While documenting the enormous loss of life caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the researchers also pinpointed the reasons behind the improvements in life expectancy in every superregion. Looking across different causes of death, the study reveals sharp drops in deaths from enteric diseases, a class of diseases that includes diarrhea and typhoid. These improvements resulted in life expectancy worldwide increasing by 1.1 years between 1990 and 2021. Reductions in deaths from lower respiratory infections added 0.9 years of global life expectancy during this period. Progress in preventing deaths from other causes also drove up life expectancy around the world. This includes stroke, neonatal disorders, ischemic heart disease, and cancer. For each disease, reductions in deaths were most pronounced between 1990 and 2019. The Global Burden of Disease Study 2021 highlights places that have made huge strides in preventing deaths from major diseases and injuries. It also emphasizes how some of the most burdensome diseases are now concentrated in certain locations, underscoring opportunities for intervention. For example, in 2021, deaths from enteric diseases were largely concentrated in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. For another disease, malaria, the researchers found that 90% of deaths occurred in an area inhabited by just 12% of the world's population, in a stretch of land ranging from western sub-Saharan Africa through central Africa to Mozambique. We already know how to save children from dying from enteric infections, including diarrheal diseases, and progress in fighting this disease has been tremendous, said Professor Mohsen Naghavi, the study's first co-author and the director of Subnational Burden of Disease Estimation at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Now we need to focus on preventing and treating the diseases, these diseases, strengthening and expanding immunization programs, and developing brand new vaccines against E. coli, norovirus, and Shigella, he added. In addition to providing new insights on COVID-19, the study reveals growing threats from non-communicable diseases, such as diabetes and kidney disease, which are increasing in every country. The researchers also point to uneven progress against conditions such as ischemic heart disease, stroke, and cancer. High-income countries have driven down deaths from many types of non-communicable diseases, but many lower-income countries have not. The global community must ensure that the life-saving tools that have cut deaths from ischemic heart disease, stroke, and other non-communicable diseases in most high-income countries are available to people in all countries, even where resources are limited, said Eve Wool, senior author of the study and senior research manager at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. So, good news on increases in life expectancy globally over the last 30 years or so. Okay, well, next up, I have a story on one of the challenges that was mentioned briefly in the last story, this from Medical Express. Consensus statement calls for urgent action to address chronic kidney disease on the global public health agenda. In contrast to cardiovascular disease, stroke, and respiratory disease, chronic kidney disease mortality rates have been on a troubling rise. Presently, kidney disease stands as the third fastest growing cause of death worldwide, with deaths attributable to kidney disease surging by 50% from 2000 to 2019, said Masuomi Nanguku, professor of the International Society of Nephrology. Chronic kidney disease and acute kidney injury present significant challenges to global health, particularly in low- and middle-income countries, where access to care and preventive services is limited. The World Bank highlights that chronic kidney disease is responsible for the largest number of people suffering catastrophic healthcare expenditures annually, particularly in low- and middle-income countries. More than 1 million individuals with potentially reversible acute kidney injury succumb yearly due to the lack of timely therapies, including dialysis, underscoring the urgency of addressing access gaps in healthcare services. The consensus statement deplores the underrepresentation of kidney disease in media and public discourse, with an 11-fold disparity between discussed versus actual causes of death. So that's one of the reasons why we have, just for the health of it, available for you is to point out these underreported stories. And this is a fascinating statistic that kidney disease has an 11-fold disparity between discussed versus the actual causes of death. So put that on your radar, kidney disease. This consensus statement marks a significant first step in recognizing the impact kidney diseases have on more than 850 million people globally and the need to eliminate disparities in kidney health and achieve equity in kidney care for people from all walks of life. Okay, well, various disparities is at the heart of many public health problems, and this next story gets on one alluded to the first story. Heart disease is still the number one killer worldwide, and this story from Medical Express gets at one of those challenges. Low-income U.S. adults left behind, while rest of U.S. experienced large declines in heart attack and stroke risk over 30 years. Over the last three decades, heart disease deaths have plummeted in the U.S., but a new study suggests cardiovascular benefits apply only to people in higher-income populations. For poor populations, heart attack rates stayed the same or got worse during that 30-year period. When the researchers explored the distribution of these changes according to household income, they found much of the heart-healthy benefits were not experienced equally among members of society. Although the 10-year cardiovascular risk fell from 7.7 to 5.1 for the wealthiest segment of the population, and from 7.6 to 6.1% for the second wealthiest group, cardiovascular risk for people with the lowest incomes remained stagnated at over 8%. This study was not designed to look for the underlying reasons behind the inequities, but other research demonstrates that improvements in treatments and improved risk factor control each explained approximately half the decline in cardiovascular mortality over this period. And that is likely in that it is the likely case that differential trends in treatment access and risk factors contribute to the widening income-related inequalities. The United States is the only high-income country without a universal health insurance system, and even poor people with insurance face financial, transportation, and other barriers to care access. Income and other measures of socioeconomic status and power fundamentally shape the landscape of opportunity to lead healthy and long lives in the United States. Tobacco smoking, obesity, and diabetes are increasingly concentrated among lower-income groups, and relative to other high-income countries, the U.S. invests less in a wide array of policies that promote the social determinants of health, including paid childcare, medical and family leave, food and nutrition benefits, and others that blunt the unhealthy effects of poverty. So we see both disparities between income groups in the U.S. and, of course, worldwide in lower and middle income countries versus wealthier countries. Okay, next up, a story on cancer and disability, this from Medical Express. More than 25% of cancer survivors report significant levels of disability after cancer diagnosis, according to a new study. A survey of nearly 50,000 cancer survivors has found that more than a quarter had a physical disability that impaired their mobility, and almost 10% had a disability affecting self-care. The Dana-Farber Cancer Institute researchers report in a new study published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. Both rates are sharply higher than those for adults who have not had cancer. If the findings are extended to the estimated 18 million cancer survivors in the U.S., they suggest that more than 5 million survivors have a mobility disability and 1.3 million have a self-care disability. The impact of such disabilities falls especially heavily on members of racial and ethnic minorities, underserved groups, and individuals with unhealthy lifestyles or other medical conditions. The study findings underscore the importance of developing ways to limit the long-term side effects of cancer treatment and the benefits of exercise, both during and after treatment, to preserve physical function and ward off disability. The effects of cancer and its treatment can lead to a variety of physical limitations that impairs people's quality of life and ability to care for themselves, says Chow Cao, first author of the study. After adjusting for demographic and lifestyle factors and health conditions, the researchers found that 28% of cancer survivors had a mobility disability, such as difficulty walking or climbing stairs, compared to 13% among non-cancer adults. And 7.4% of survivors had a disability in self-care activities, such as dressing or bathing, compared to less than 4% of non-cancer adults. Investigators also found different rates of disability within different groups of survivors. Female survivors, for example, were significantly more likely to report mobility problems than male survivors. Mobility-related disabilities were also more common in non-Hispanic Blacks, Native Americans, and Hispanics compared to non-Hispanic whites. Low educational attainment, low family annual income, being unmarried, having obesity, current smoking, being physically inactive, and having a chronic condition were also associated with a higher prevalence of mobility disability among cancer survivors. And I just would like to note for context that comparing, if you look at the leading causes of death, you find a proportional amount of disability in the wake of that. And that's true for cancer, heart disease, your other major killers. The one main thing that where that differs is in psychiatric and particularly major depression. Depression doesn't necessarily kill a lot of people, but it is the leading cause of disability in the world. That's the kind of perspective you get by listening to Just for the Health of It. Okay, well, next up, a story on what looks like it might be an interesting trend with hepatitis C. This from MedPage Today. Start of a new trend? Hepatitis C cases drop in the U.S. New U.S. hepatitis C infections dropped slightly in 2022, a surprising improvement after more than a decade of steady increases, federal health officials said. Drops in infection rates did not occur across the board. They declined for white Americans, but continued to rise for Black, Latino, and Native American communities, according to Neil Gupta, who oversees the branch of the CDC that tracks viral hepatitis. The hepatitis C virus is spread through contact with blood from an infected person. The virus does most of its damage by infecting the liver, and if left untreated can lead to cirrhosis or liver cancer. Infections are driven mainly by people injecting illicit drugs. Data released by the CDC for 2022 shows almost 5,000 new infections, down from just over 5,000 reported the year before. The CDC estimates about 67,000 new hepatitis C infections actually occurred in 2022 because many people who become infected don't realize it, meaning most new infections are not diagnosed and reported. But that too is down from 70,000 estimated for 2021. So that's a stunning example of how, you know, our screening for hepatitis C only catches a small fraction. If you're catching about 5,000 infections and you're talking about over 10 times that many of estimated actual infections. Okay, the new infection rate used to better compare data from one year to another dropped 6%. Though the decline is encouraging, Gupta said, the 2022 statistics are still twice as high as what the nation saw in just 2015. Cases had consistently gone up since 2013 during the long-standing opioid epidemic due to drug users shooting heroin and fentanyl. Experts say a couple of factors could have contributed to a decline in 2022, including successful prevention efforts and needle exchanges. The North American Syringe Exchange Network keeps a directory of U.S. programs, and listings have grown from about 300 to nearly 500 in the last several years, said Paul Lukoski, the executive director of the North American Syringe Exchange Network. Many programs have also boosted hepatitis C testing and found ways to get infected people to treatment, he noted. But Lukoski and others think something else may be at play too. Drug users are shifting from injecting to smoking. A recent CDC report found that between early 2020 and late 2022, the percentage of overdose deaths with evidence of smoking rose 74%, while the percentage of deaths with evidence of injection fell 29%. Fewer people injecting drugs like fentanyl means fewer opportunities for the spread of hepatitis C, experts noted. There's been a tremendous shift in the way people are consuming their drugs. There's been a decrease in demand for syringes. We've seen this nationwide, said Lukoski, who added there is more demand for supplies to snort or smoke drugs. More than 2 million Americans are infected with hepatitis C. Some of them have lived with infections for many years. About 12,700 Americans died in 2022 of hepatitis C-related causes, according to the CDC. Okay, next up, let's do a story on my ongoing coverage of antimicrobial resistance, which, if we don't deal with well, could be the number one cause of death by 2050. This from Medical Express. Urgent action needed to combat antimicrobial resistance. Political leaders are ignoring the growing danger of antimicrobial resistance, which could lead to an unprecedented health and economic catastrophe, a high-level task force warned. The world now has a limited and critical window of opportunity to respond at the scale and the urgency proportionate to the rapidly increasing threats posed by antimicrobial resistance, according to a report published last Thursday by the Global Steering Group on Antimicrobial Resistance. Resistance to antimicrobials, antibiotics, antifungals, and antiparasitics is already wreaking havoc and is a result of the massive use of these products to treat humans, animals, and food. Evidence is mounting that changes occurring in the natural environment due to the climate crisis are increasing the spread of infectious disease, potential including drug-resistance infections. The report is part of an effort to spur action by global leaders ahead of a meeting in New York on September 26th. Microbes that are not completely eradicated by a given substance can develop resistance to that product, gradually reducing the arsenal of drugs available to treat infections. Antimicrobial resistance is already one of the world's leading causes of death, directly responsible for 1.27 million deaths a year, including one in five in children under five, mainly in low and middle-income countries, the report said. If left unchecked, antimicrobial resistance is expected to reduce life expectancy by an average of 1.8 years by 2035, leading to unprecedented healthcare costs and economic losses. Within a decade, antimicrobial resistance is estimated to cost the world $412 billion a year in additional health costs and $443 billion a year in lost labor productivity, according to an economic impact study commissioned by the Global Steering Group. Effective measures against the scourge are expected to cost an average of $46 billion a year, but it will yield up to $13 for every dollar spent by 2050, according to the impact study. So I want to just stop and focus that on a moment. If you were running public health like a business, like people talk about running government like a business, well, this is a perfect example of where the common good of decreasing antimicrobial resistance and having effective treatments can yield up to $13 for every dollar spent. That is a fantastic investment. So part of the question would be, why wouldn't you do that? And of course, if you can answer that question, you understand a lot of the dynamics of why public health can be a real challenge. Okay, on with the story. We have the tools to mitigate the antimicrobial resistant crisis, and these data point to a devastating future if we don't take bolder action now. Commitment to the fight against antimicrobial resistance must be personal, local, national, and global. The working group is making suggestions both in terms of mobilizing funding, particularly from international financial institutions, and towards finding ways of overcoming the obstacles to researching and manufacturing effective new drugs. Another objective is to reduce the quantity of antimicrobials used in the global agri-food system by 30 to 50% compared to current levels. More boldly, the group proposes to eliminate by 2030 the use of medically important antimicrobials in human and animal medicine for non-veterinary medical purposes. So I've talked about this a lot. We need to stop feeding antibiotics that are used to treat human disease in animals. Okay, well, next up, there's a sort of related story to this. This is from Stat News, how climate change is driving a global epidemic of immune health problems and how to stop it. Many of the effects of climate change play out at a very large scale. Heat waves that grip entire continents, flooding that submerges vast swaths of island nations and continental coastal areas. Other effects are far less visible because they're taking place inside people's bodies. That doesn't make them any less dangerous. Diseases linked to problems in immune health have been steadily rising over the past few decades. Nasal allergies in children more than doubled from 2012 to 2022. Food allergies, which can be deadly, have also spiked. The global prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis has jumped 14% since 1990. Young people are increasingly vulnerable to colorectal cancer. To be sure, climate change isn't the only culprit here. Diets heavy in ultra-processed foods, lack of exercise, high levels of stress, and improved testing all likely contribute to rising disease rates. Yet there is also strong evidence at both the biological and the epidemiological levels that the environment plays a crucial role in the rise of immune-mediated diseases. As I and a group of colleagues from the U.S. and Europe just reported in Frontiers in Science, climate-driven stressors are driving immune dysregulation at a scope that has contributed to an increase in immune-mediated diseases. As a physician and a scientist, I believe this epidemic of immune disease must be treated at its source, and that includes tackling climate change. Climate change derails the human immune system in two key ways. It breaks down the body's defenses and also prevents the body from rebuilding them. Consider the wide array of irritants that climate change routinely brings into communities all around the world. Wildfires release dangerous quantities of tiny soot particles in the air. Flooding dumps industrial chemicals into waterways and often leaves mold spores sprouting in homes. Unusually warm springs boost the production of ragweed and other pollens. All these exposures damage the structures that have evolved to protect humans from infection, including the skin and the mucous membranes of the gut and the lungs. How does climate change make it harder to build strong immune systems in the first place? Humans need nutritious diets and exposure to a vast array of microbial, fungal, plant, and animal species to train and sustain a robust immune system. All of that is under threat with climate change. Warmer climates irrevocably alter ecosystems, forcing species to move or become extinct. For the humans left behind, fewer interactions with diverse species means a less resilient immune system. Extreme weather has also destroyed crops and livestock in many parts of the world, leading to an alarming rise in hunger and famine. Even when crops do grow, they may not be as nutritious. Food staples such as wheat, corn, rice, and soy lose significant nutrient content when exposed to high levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Malnourishment also prevents healthy immune system development. The impact of all these stressors is visible at the cellular level. Scientists have traced the impact of many exposures through cascades of chemical interactions that damage the body's protective barriers and disrupt the delicate balance of the immune system. In many cases, this actually activates the body's inflammatory responses and leaves it on, even when it should be turned off. Such persistent inflammation fuels an array of diseases, including cancer. Scientists understand why more and more of the world's people are experiencing higher rates of immune-mediated diseases. The question now is whether anything can be done about it. Fortunately, the answer is an unequivocal yes. In our paper in Frontiers in Science, my colleagues and I reviewed the global rise in immune-mediated diseases. We concluded that for every $1 spent on mitigating climate change, could save at least $3 in healthcare costs. That's an impressive return on investment, and it doesn't even account for the reduction in human suffering. Once again, another great investment. Why wouldn't we want to do that? Even if you're only concerned about money. Of course, our concern about money isn't usually about what's most efficient or effective overall, but what lands in our pockets. On with the story. These improvements aren't hypothetical. Where policies have changed, health benefits have followed. In the 1980s and 1990s, for instance, efforts to tackle air pollution in the U.S. led to a dramatic decrease in fine particulate soot in Southern California and cut the incidence of asthma among local children by 20%. In Seoul, Korea, clean air policies prevented 500,000 hospital visits for asthma over the course of 4 years. There is now an urgent need to implement such policies at global scale. My colleagues and I call for a renewed focus on balancing human needs with ecosystem needs to protect the health of both our planet and its people. We urge rapid global action to cut greenhouse gas emissions from activities, including agriculture, waste management, and transportation. Addressing immune health problems on a global scale will also require major investments in food security and sustainable agriculture in a bid to improve every community's access to nourishing foods. Policymakers can promote their citizens' exposure to a broad array of plant and animal life, which also fosters strong immune systems. By creating and protecting more green spaces and encouraging access to wilder ecosystems such as national parks. Even housing policy can be brought to bear on the crisis. Funds to help people strengthen their homes against the ravages of extreme weather, remove mold, and improve indoor air quality can all help reduce exposure to immune irritants. In addition to bold policy changes, the U.S. and other governments must fund more research focused on understanding immune health problems in the context of climate change. This will require global investments in data collection and analysis, as well as concerted efforts to evaluate the impact of mitigation and adaptation strategies on population health. New economic models to better account for the health benefits of policies designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are needed. These should help make the case for these policies even stronger. Above all, it is essential for scientists, clinicians, journalists, politicians, anyone with a platform, really, to keep explaining to the public that climate change has very real effects on the human body. These aren't spread evenly across the globe. Some communities and regions are more vulnerable than others. We must work together to combat this shared threat. The destructive force of climate change is already showing up in an epidemic of immune health problems. Only by acting now can the worst damage be prevented. And I've reported a lot about basically endocrine disrupting chemicals. This is also something that affects our immune system and has been something that has changed a lot in recent decades. And of course, this is also tied to the petrochemical industry in that we use a lot of petrochemicals to produce a lot of compounds that end up in our environment and in our bodies, which affect both human health, animals, and plant life on our shared planet. Okay, well, next up, we're going to switch gears and do a couple healthcare stories. This one from The Hill. LGBTQ Americans twice as likely to experience discrimination in healthcare. A new survey found that LGBTQ Americans are twice as likely to experience discrimination in their healthcare. The survey, conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation, noted that members of the LGBTQ community have historically faced disparities while receiving healthcare, including challenges to accessing mental and physical healthcare. LGBTQ adults are also twice as likely as non-LGBTQ adults to report negative experiences while receiving health care in the last 3 years, including being treated unfairly or with disrespect, the report found. 33% of LGBTQ adults reported negative experiences while receiving health care in the previous 3 years, compared to 15% of non-LGBTQ adults. LGBTQ adults were also twice as likely to report a healthcare provider would assume something about them, suggest they were personally to blame for a health problem, ignore requests or questions, or refuse to prescribe needed pain medication. 61% of LGBTQ adults reported experiencing such treatment, compared to 31% of non-LGBTQ adults. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that adults of color reported discrimination at higher rates than white patients, but among LGBTQ adults, these experiences appear to cut across racial and ethnic groups. 24% of LGBTQ adults say their negative healthcare experience caused their health to get worse, compared to 9% of non-LGBTQ adults. 6 in 10 LGBTQ adults say they prepare to be insulted by healthcare providers and say they feel the need to be careful about their appearance in order to be treated fairly while seeking care. The survey found that LGBTQ Americans are more likely to say their mental health is fair or poor and say experiencing discrimination makes their mental health worse. Nearly 70% of LGBTQ Americans who said their mental health was fair or poor also reported going without mental health services despite needing these services at least once in the prior 3 years. The report comes as several states target LGBTQ rights. Nearly half of transgender people in the U.S. have considered moving to another state because anti-trans legislation in their home state threatens to end gender-affirming health care, access to public restrooms, and the ability to play school sports, a separate survey found. So, anti-LGBTQ discrimination is alive and well in our healthcare system. We can do better. Listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health and the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, an area that is also very challenging for our healthcare system. This from Pew Trust. Few hospitals follow recommended practices for evidence-based suicide care. In 2022, suicide claimed the lives of an estimated 49,449 people in the U.S., making it the 11th leading cause of death nationwide. Research has shown that almost half of those who die by suicide interact with the healthcare system within 4 weeks of their death, and those who are hospitalized for suicide risk face an elevated risk of dying by suicide post-discharge, making this a critical time for these patients to have access to resources, support, and care that can keep them safe in the event of a suicidal crisis. But new research shows that only 8% of hospitals in the U.S. have instituted all of the key components of evidence-based best practice interventions to help at-risk patients who are discharged after receiving care. In fact, more than 1 in 4 are not conducting any of these 4 interventions. The Joint Commission, an independent national organization that accredits U.S. hospitals, requires its nearly 3,800 facilities, which is about 80% of all hospitals and behavioral care organizations, to have discharge policies and protocols for counseling and follow-up care in place for individuals identified as being at risk for suicide. However, the specific policies and protocols adopted to meet these requirements are left to the hospital's discretion. To gain insight into current practices, the Joint Commission, in partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust, conducted a nationally representative survey of accredited non-psychiatric hospitals in the U.S. The findings were published in the Joint Commission Journal on Quality and Patient Safety. The study focused on 4 suicide prevention practices for providing immediate care and access to follow-up services for patients at risk for suicide, as recommended by the survey's scientific advisors. These practices include formal safety planning, such as equipping patients with concrete steps that they can take or people they can talk to if they need help, providing warm handoffs to outpatient care, which means when a hospital physician introduces a patient to a behavioral health specialist in person, following up with patients after discharge, most often to conduct wellness checks, and providing what is known as lethal means safety planning, such as working with patients to voluntarily remove lethal objects, such as firearms, from their possession. According to the survey, most hospitals have implemented one or two of these practices, but few apply all four concurrently. Specifically, 61% of accredited hospitals conduct formal safety planning, 37% provide warm handoffs to outpatient care, 30% follow up with patients after discharge, and 28% provide lethal means safety planning. About 3/4 of accredited hospitals, that is 73%, reported conducting at least one of the four interventions. 47% said they're conducting at least two, 18% at least three, and only 8% all four. Nearly 27% of accredited hospitals are not using any of the four interventions. And this just highlights how our healthcare system, which is designed primarily to deal with physical health problems, has a lot of room for improvement in dealing with mental health problems, one of the worst being suicide. Okay, well, next up, let's move from hospitals not doing nearly as much as they could be doing to prevent suicide among patients and former patients that are leaving their care, to police officers who are using excessive violence. This from the Associated Press. Key findings from AP's investigation into police force that isn't supposed to be lethal. Every day, police in the U.S. rely on common use of force tactics that, unlike guns, are meant to stop people without killing them. But when misused, these tactics can still end in death. Over a decade, more than 1,000 people died after police subdued them through physical holds, stun guns, body blows, and other means not intended to be lethal, as an investigation led by the Associated Press found. In hundreds of cases, officers weren't taught or didn't follow best safety practices for this force, creating a recipe for death. Medical officials cited law enforcement as causing or contributing to about half of the deaths. In many others, significant police force went unmentioned, and drugs or pre-existing health problems were blamed instead. The deadly encounters happened just about everywhere, according to an analysis of the database Associated Press created. Big cities, suburbs, and rural America. Red states and blue states, restaurants, assisted living centers, and most commonly in or near the homes of those who died. The deceased came from all walks of life. A poet, a nurse, a saxophone player in a mariachi band, a truck driver, a sales director, a rodeo clown, and even a few off-duty law enforcement officers. All but 3% of the dead were men. Most tended to be in their 30s and 40s. The youngest was just 15, the oldest 95. The toll, however, disproportionately fell on Black Americans. They made up 1/3 of those who died, despite representing only 12% of the U.S. population. Others feeling the brunt were those impaired by a medical, mental health, or drug emergency, a group particularly susceptible to force even when lightly applied. In about 30% of the cases, police were intervening to stop people who were injuring others or who posed a threat of danger. But roughly 25% of those who died were threatening no one or, at most, committing minor infractions. The rest involved other nonviolent situations with people who police said were trying to resist arrest or flee. What led up to the force was sometimes unclear. In more than 100 cases, police either withheld key details or witnesses disputed the officer's account, and body camera footage didn't exist to help add clarity. In hundreds of cases, officers repeated errors that experts and trainers have spent years trying to eliminate. Perhaps the best example is how officers were warned that holding someone face down in what is known as prone to restraint is dangerous. Many policing experts agree that someone can stop breathing if pinned on their chest for too long or with too much weight, and the Department of Justice has issued warnings to that effect since 1995. Reporters identified dozens and dozens of cases in which officers disregarded people who told them they were struggling for air or even about to die, often uttering the words, "I can't breathe," but with no standard national rules, what police are taught about the risks of prone restraint is often left to the states and individual departments. Some officers involved in fatalities testified that they had been assured that prone position was never deadly, while many others were trained to roll people onto their sides to aid breathing and simply failed to do so. Others were usually cleared by their departments in internal investigations. The AP investigation identified just 28 deaths where officers end up charged by prosecutors. the feds don't keep count very well. The Associated Press and its partners focused on local police, sheriff deputies, and other officers patrolling the streets or responding to dispatch calls. Reporters filed nearly 7,000 requests for government documents and body camera footage, receiving more than 700 autopsy reports or death certificates, and uncovering video in at least 4 dozen cases that has never been published or widely distributed. Those records led them to identify at least 1,036 deaths after police had used what is known as less lethal force during the decade of 2012 through 2021, an average of 2 deaths a week. The federal government, for its part, has struggled for years and years to count these deaths. Congress started trying to get the Justice Department to do so in 2000. The department has acknowledged its data is incomplete, blames spotty reporting from police departments, and does not make whatever information does exist publicly available. Mortality data maintained by the CDC also has gaps. The Associated Press found that when a death certificate does not list words such as police and law enforcement, the CDC's language reading software doesn't label the death as involving legal intervention. This means the death data flagged police involvement in, at most, 34% of the deaths the AP investigation identified. Because the country has no clear idea how many people die like this and why, meaningful reforms will remain difficult, said Dr. Roger Mitchell Jr., a leader in the push to improve tracking and one of the nation's few black chief medical examiners, when he held the office in Washington, D.C. from 2014 to 2021. Anytime anyone dies before their day in court or dies in an environment where the federal government or the local government's job is to take care of you, he said, it needs transparency. It cannot be in the dark of night. Amen to that. Okay, well, next up, let's close out the regular reporting of this episode with a global health story and a good example of how public health works. This from Medical Express. WHO announces giant rollout of cholera tests as cases surge. The largest ever global deployment of cholera rapid diagnostic tests got underway last Friday, the World Health Organization and its partners said, boosting the fight against surging infections. In total, more than 1.2 million tests will be distributed to 14 high-risk countries over coming months, the UN Health Agency said in a statement. The program is aimed at helping countries speed up and improve the accuracy of cholera outbreak detection and response by boosting routine surveillance and testing capacity. Cholera, which is contracted from a bacterium generally transmitted through contaminated food or water, causes diarrhea and vomiting and can be especially dangerous for young children. Cases have been surging in recent years, with 473,000 globally reported to WHO in 2022, which was double the previous year, and preliminary data indicating that more than 700,000 cases were reported last year. The soaring number of outbreaks has created unprecedented demand for vaccines from impacted countries. Even though the global supply of oral cholera vaccines ballooned 18-fold between 2013 and 2023, the surging demand has created a global shortage. WHO last month called for immediate action to address the shortage, warning of unprecedented pressure on the global stockpile of vaccines. The situation has forced delays in preventative vaccination campaigns to preserve doses for emergency outbreak responses. At the same time, recurring outbreaks in countries where emergency vaccination campaigns have already been carried out shows a clear need to improve the speed and accuracy in identifying areas where new or persistent transmission is occurring. Surveillance diagnostics help pinpoint hotspots with great precision, said Lila Pakala, head of UNICEF's supply division. This allows partners to target cholera vaccines to exactly the time and place where the limited supply will save the most lives. And this is just a really good example how even when you're kind of under-resourced and having to use resources very carefully, public health tries to do a very good job to do the best it can with what limited resources it may have. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 22 bonus articles this week. First up, number one, bracing for a surge in prostate cancer diagnoses. Demographic changes will lead to a doubling of cases, 85% increase in mortality by 2040. So I wanted to lead with this one just as a little bit of a case study. This is true and is an important thing. Of course, the surge is largely due to populations getting older, and cancer is very highly correlated with age, just like a lot of non-communicable diseases, a lot of chronic diseases. So that's good, something you should pay attention to. Bonus Article 2, Global Cancer Statistics 2022, estimates of incidence and mortality worldwide for 36 cancers in 185 countries, which is a really long article that I pretty much cite just to give you my sources. But this, in fact, shows that while this is true for prostate cancer, you're going to see, you know, a doubling of cases and 85% increase in mortality by 2040. This is actually not much different from basically all cancer diagnoses. And again, this has to do largely with demographic changes. You're seeing older populations throughout the world, and that is highly associated with cancer. So it means we need to switch out. And, you know, as far as healthcare and treatment and screening and all that kind of stuff. But it's not because of, you know, some carcinogen in the environment necessarily or whatever. It's just simple, the success of living longer. Bonus Article 3, what to know about the debate over U.S. maternal mortality rates. So this is another interesting article for you public health freaks out there. They're interested in a little bit of a nuance and a longer read. I'll give you the gist here. There was a recent article where they were challenging whether the maternal mortality rates are being calculated and accounted for accurately. They made some big changes a couple decades ago, and they actually stopped reporting them for many years while they were waiting for this change to roll out and level out. And they made some more recent changes a few years ago, which tweaked what they learned over the, you know, the 10 or 15 years of having made a basic change on death certificates, linking, you know, basically putting a checkbox on death certificates of whether there was a pregnancy in the previous year. So the bottom line is maternal mortality rates are likely going up, and none of this changes any of the dynamics of the importance of maternal mortality rates as far as racial ethnic disparities, as far as some of the changes we've seen, like, for instance, with restricting access to reproductive health care, having a threat to maternal health. And also, this is focused on pregnancy deaths, and it's, if you look at the deaths that happened up to a year, generally the ones that they're talking about are ones that happen in the first, I think, 45 days. But there's a lot of deaths that happen 45 days post-pregnancy to 1 year post-pregnancy. And these are also of great concern and often related to maternal health conditions. Maternal health and mortality is not simply just pregnancy related. There's maternal things such as violence and substance abuse that are changed by the condition of pregnancy or bringing a child into the family. And bonus article 4 is whooping cough is resurging worldwide due to superbugs and lower vaccination rates. So this is something where we're seeing a lot of outbreaks worldwide. We're seeing, whooping cough is a bacteria, and that's one that we're seeing changes with antimicrobial resistance. We're getting stronger bugs, so that's a problem in of itself. And particularly after the COVID-19 pandemic, we're seeing lower vaccination rates for whooping cough. And this is, again, something that affects the very, very young. And you can only give the vaccination after a little while for the young kids. So you really need to surround them with parents and grandparents and others that are going to be around the infants to be vaccinated. Bonus Article 5. Why a leading bird flu expert isn't convinced that the risk H5N1 poses to people has declined. So this is the bird flu stuff that's being stirred up once again, as we saw cows, another large mammal, being infected. And this is not a good sign. Kind of the cows are the canaries in the coal mine in this way, just showing that bird flu is a force to be reckoned with, and we need to keep a close eye on it. And one expert knows that there's enough uncertainty about this that risk, a high risk, could be lurking on the horizon. Bonus Article 6, FDA approves first prescription digital therapy to aid major depression treatment. So First of all, you have to recognize that the FDA is responsible for approving effective therapies, even if they're digital. And with this one particularly, it's not a sole treatment for major depression, but it's an adjunct. It's meant to be added on to other treatment and has been shown to have a significant benefit. Bonus Article 7, artificial intelligence tools offer promise for public health when used ethically. So for those of you who've listened to the show, recognize that I'm more of a doomer rather than a boomer with AI and have some great concerns all the way up to the existential level. But public health, which uses a lot of data, can benefit a lot from AI. And of course, we shouldn't turn our eyes away and our resources away from using AI to benefit the public good and the public health. Of course, the when used ethically is one of the most challenging things, probably less so in public health per se, but when you have capitalism leading the way for very expensive and resource-intensive things such as AI, it tends to be the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and criminals finding a wonderful tool. Bonus Article 8, 1 in 7 women of reproductive age have a personal connection to abortion restrictions, and that jumps to 1 in 5 in states with abortion bans. Bonus Article 9, Florida's stricter ban on abortions could put more pressure on clinics elsewhere. So the state court in Florida upheld their 6-week abortion ban, and that's really important because Florida is a big state, and it's a state in the South, which if it goes away as far as abortion availability, is going to require other women in other states nearby in Florida to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles more to get abortion care. And on that same note, Bonus Article 10, Florida's abortion fight is headed to voters after court allows for 6-week ban. So the court also allowed a ballot initiative. Now they need a 60% threshold to pass it, which is difficult, but Florida is going to be able to decide that. Bonus Article 11, Ohio law banning nearly all abortions now invalid after ballot initiative referendum, Attorney General says. So this is good news and part of the rollout of securing in the Ohio State Constitution a right to reproductive health. Part of the problem with this is that the Attorney General is overturning the heart of the law, heart of the heartbeat law, but it is requiring still parts of the law not to be completely overturned, but to keep things like you have to tell the pregnant woman when there's a heartbeat, and doctors need to document the reason for an abortion, which of course is another thing that you could arguably say is none of their business. Okay, moving on to a few stories about our sketchy health system. Bonus Article 12, 10 doctors on FDA panel reviewing Abbott heart device had financial ties with the company. So this is both a problem with not having policies at all, and of course in some of these cases you have policies but they're not actually followed, but that a lot of these experts are tied with the companies and are being paid sometimes very large sums of money, which of course is a conflict of interest. And for just straight up crime, Bonus Article 13, rogue insurance agents are switching ACA plans without enrollees okay. So you don't actually need a lot of information to go on the federal exchange, which is in 32 states, and you can actually switch somebody's insurance. Now, of course, why would you want to do that? Well, if you're an insurance agent, you get, I'll call them kickbacks, but you get paid for enrolling somebody. So you can go without their permission and switch them out and you get paid. And these payments are things that you get a one-time payment, but also you get payments even in ensuing years. It starts off with a big payment and then gets less and less and may last years and years. So it's very profitable for rogue insurance agencies to do this. Straight up crime in my book. Bonus Article 14. As obesity rises, big food and dietitians push anti-diet advice. For instance, General Mills warns of food shaming. Dietitian influencers promote junk foods and discourage weight loss efforts. So there has been a legitimate movement about kind of fat acceptance and pushing it back against stigma, against differently sized people. But that has been pushed by capitalists into, you know, just gearing profitability, not about actual concern for people's health. And of course, having dietitians that are promoting the junk food industrial complex is not a very good idea. And while weight loss efforts are difficult, they are not something that you want to negate honest efforts to do. Bonus article 15. The average person with heart disease consumes twice the recommended sodium level. And the fascinating thing here is that people with heart disease who are recommended to follow heart healthy diets, and one of those things is to cut down your sodium level to 1500 milligrams a day, basically they consume just a small, very modestly less sodium than the average person. So it's just a good example of how individual efforts to control sodium are actually swimming very much up a salty stream, given our highly processed food system. And maybe our dietitian should be working on changing that food system to offer much more healthy food. Bonus article 16. A nation with too few pediatricians could see healthcare costs soar and health fall. So pediatricians are one of the most cost-effective physicians you can have, and we're seeing less and less folks going in because they get paid less. Bonus article 17, gambling addiction hotlines say volume is up and callers are younger as online sports betting booms. Smartphone apps and pervasive ads have taken sports gambling mainstream. Saw this one coming. It has arrived. 18, does addiction make you un-American? Weaponizing substance use and addiction against immigrants. A good read. Bonus article on what something may be very American. 20% of Americans say violence may be needed to get U.S. back on track. And also on the violence front, bonus article 20, drone strikes on Ukraine's nuclear plant prompt major safety concerns. Another great benefit of violence. Bonus article 21, hope is not the same as optimism, a psychologist explains. Just look at MLK's example. You can have hope even when things don't look very optimistic. And on that note, just wanted to remind people that the Gaza famine and genocide is still continuing. And while things don't look great, we can hope for the best and work for justice in that situation. Lastly, bonus article 22, let's go to our number one preventable cause of death, smoking. Anti-smoking groups sue the FDA again over menthol ban delays. And next week, we'll be covering eye damage from people staring into the sun during the eclipse without proper protection. I hope you did it safely and had an awesome time. You can view these and other stories by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.